Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Jim.
Has inflation taken a bite out of economic growth?
Well, inflation has been coming down quite rapidly. There's no question that in the 4 years, say, before 2024, the cost of living increased about 22% and the increases in wages fell far below that. So there's definitely been this increase in the cost of living, which is still with us. But in terms of the escalation from here, it's been slowing rapidly over the past many months. Things like trueflation, which is a real-time kind of estimate of U.S. inflation, is now about 1.5%. As an annualized rate. So I think that the inflation is no longer going to be the primary concern. It's really this difficulty we have because we came into the global pandemic having had interest rates so low for so long, for many years. And so when they added all the additional fiscal support and slashed rates to zero again, it really sort of was the last hurrah. It was the last ability of governments and companies and households to spend their brains out on money that was for free, essentially. And now we've got this overhang period, and it's worldwide, right? So 28 central banks have already cut interest rates. There's been 67 different cuts between 28 central banks since early 2022. And in fact, the Bank of Japan did its first rate hike this week, which was only the second increase in the last 20 years. So it's sort of looking at, it was concerned that, you know, inflation had come down significantly and they didn't want things to overheat in the economy because they've had a sort of a boom in the last little while. But all over the world, we're seeing the opposite. And it's so weird because it's this disconnect between financial markets and financial market conditions and then the real world and the banking system, right? So financial markets have been rallying in the last several months, the tech boom again since last fall, which loosens financial conditions for publicly traded companies. But it does, the banking system itself has been faced with the highest interest rates in, you know, since 2007. So we're seeing all of that impact for anybody that needs to access or raise capital in the banking system. Conditions have been really tight. And then since last fall again, anything for public markets has been exceptionally, loose again. So you've got this bifurcation, which is, you know, when you throw really cheap money at financial markets, you tend to get these boom-bust cycles, which is exactly what we're living with now. So, you know, the unforeseen consequences of that, like just the Bank of Japan increasing by 25 basis points, was you get a strengthening yen, which all these people in the financial markets, hedge funds outside of the regulated space have been doing things like borrowing in the yen to buy all these other assets because the interest rates were zero there for many years. The yen was increasingly weakening during that period. And so it was easy to borrow money there and then buy assets that were going up. Well, that action in itself was one of the things pushing assets up. But then when the central bank suddenly increases the cost of carry, the overnight rate, and you get the yen suddenly strengthening, you get this selling pressure that sweeps through all these other highly levered asset markets. And so that's happening you know, that was a big shock that came on Monday of this week. And then, you know, we've started to see some rebound in the last couple of days. But the fact of the matter is that really the tech sell-off started in July. So I don't think it's just about the Bank of Japan hiking 25 basis points. I think it's the fact that we came into this, as I say, with this habitually lower interest rates caused all this risk speculation and overbuild in the financial markets, and that's now in this mean reversion phase, which is this really long, drawn-out, painful episode. As the real economy is contracting, I mean, talk about, you know, at the same time as the Japanese stock market rallied sharply in the last year, the actual Japanese industrial production fell 7% year over year. The Chinese PMI manufacturing contracted. Canadian manufacturing activity has been down for 15 months straight. You know, so it's really, as I say, this story of financial markets and the rest. And all of that is reflected in things like the commodities market too, because you'd think if, you know, again, the contraction in manufacturing and output in the world that's going on in the real economy as it struggles with these higher borrowing rates in the banking system, you're seeing the commodity sector come off sharply. You know, copper's off now 23% from where it peaked. Oil's off about 16% since last September. Corn is the lowest that we've seen since in a long time, many years. Steel's off 40%. You know, you can just go through the list. So you're saying, well, if you believe the stock market in the last few months, it's been this story of optimism and, you know, expectations of endless growth and earnings, et cetera. When you look at all the things that matter in the real economy, you're getting this downshift. And, like things like treasury bond yields, the treasury bond prices have actually been rising now for many months, which is helping to bring down mortgage rates, and yet we're not seeing the revival in housing demand. So, you know, U.S. 30-year mortgage rates, because the 30-year bond price has been rallying in the last while, they're back under 6% today, but sales have not rebounded, and mortgage application, refinancing, all that's really down. So the only growth that we've really seen in the economy, certainly in the American economy and all over the world, has been this drawdown in personal savings. So any savings that households had amassed during the handouts of the pandemic are basically all drawn down. An increase in government spending, which is again, a hangover from this fiscal largesse period where they pumped all this money into the world economy. And then you've got inventories, which are rising. So China, being as it's in such a downshift and its real estate market is really falling completely apart, they've been, you know, trying to stimulate their economy through fiscal spending and promotion into their manufacturing sector. And they've pumped out a ton of really cheap goods, which they cannot absorb in their own economy. And so they're now dumping that onto the world market. At the same time, you're getting this rising protectionist rhetoric worldwide of, you know, governments, whatever party wins in the U.S. In the fall, is promising to really step up this tariffs on Chinese goods. And so you've got a bunch of companies now trying to, you know, build up their inventories again in the hopes that that you're going to see a rebound in demand. But it's just not showing up in the data. So far, we're having a lot of the bull market right now is in bankruptcies and insolvency proposals, in people handing over keys to lenders, in asset write-downs in terms of, again, everything in the real economy is realizing that money isn't free anymore and that they overpaid so dramatically. You know, we're starting to see that filter through, of course, into the job market. We've already had the Canadian unemployment rate rise to 6.4%. U.S. unemployment, the July number rose to 4.3%. That's the highest in nearly 3 years, similar to what it was in March of 2001 in that tech-led recession as well. And more importantly, even the average work week, which I've spoken before, but basically companies try not and lay off people wherever possible. They, you know, they try and keep their workers on, but they've got a big downdraft in revenue and sales right now going on, throughout many sectors of the economy, most actually. So the average work week has fallen to just 34.2 hours a week in July. That's about as low as it can get before they have to increase job cuts again. And of course, we've got this irony of the AI layover, where 85% of the CFOs surveyed recently said they're using AI to lower their labor costs. So wherever they can save, you know, expenses, that's the focus. It's not so much about how do I get revenue from the AI story, that they haven't figured that out yet, and how to increase cash flow. So it's a story of how do we use this to lower our costs. So you're seeing JOLTS hiring data. The U.S. JOLTS hiring data was off by more than 9% year over year. 96% of Americans who've entered the labor force in the last year haven't been able to find a job. You know, all these immigrants that people keep talking about, how they've been coming in and taking our jobs, the truth is most of them have not been able to find a job in the last year. So that is adding to the, you know, the unemployment rolls. Intel, here's another, you know, example of the real economy story. While you've had this big surge in the tech part of the stock market, which we've talked about before, how it really rallied, you know, and became 34% of the overall S&P, record concentration in just a handful of these big tech number names. Intel's right at the forefront, right with the chip sector, of supposedly that whole boom, and yet they're seeing their sales revenues falling. And they, this week, announced they were going to be cutting their global workforce by 15%, and they suspended their dividend last week. So in a heartbeat, their shares have fallen now 34%. Again, this whole unrealistic expectations of insatiable demand for chips and AI and how that's going to, you know, solve all the problems of the world, when in fact we've got this massive overbuild now across the board. And all the central banks are looking at that, like the Bank of Canada, in its recent missive, was saying, you know, yes, they cut rates a second to 25 basis points in Canada, but they were saying that they can see this excess capacity story persisting for at least a couple of years. They talked a lot about the excess supply when they did their press conference, and that's not something that's going to go away quickly. So that means you've got to have clearing events. You've got to have, you know, if you think about stores that have too much goods, or wholesalers that have too much goods, they have to lower prices to get rid of it. They have to do clearance sales, and that's really needed across the board. So, you know, a lot of people are hoping that all we need is central banks to cut interest rates more, and suddenly that's going to fix all this. And I've been writing to remind people that we didn't see the impact of the cuts instantly. It took a couple, of the hikes that took place from 22 to 24, 23. They didn't show up instantly in terms of, you know, curtailing demand and spending. They took a couple of years to filter through. And the same happens with the cuts story, right? So, the U.S. Fed is now expected to cut 50 basis points in September just because of this, you know, fallout that's happened in the stock market this week. There, you know, everyone's banking, well, the Fed won't tolerate, you know, falling stock prices, like as if they have the power to stop it once the sentiment turns, which they do not, Jim. They've never had that. So everyone is now hoping that the Fed is going to start cutting in September because they're very much behind the eight ball here now. Like I said, inflation's moderated, growth is weak, revenues are falling across the board. Whatever company you look at, it's been really quite shocking, the latest announcements, not just Intel, but, you know, whether you pick Lululemon, Starbucks, P&G, like diapers and detergent, they're saying their sales way off. Hershey's, Amazon said their sales, their outlook is weak. Whether it's, you know, McDonald's and junk food companies, or Apple iPhone sales, or even luxury brands, you know, across the board, they're all saying the consumer is tapped out. We're seeing we can't keep up the pace of sales. We have excess capacity. You know, Ford, Tesla, Porsche, Gucci, all these companies have missed. Polaris, they're not seeing demand for ATVs, boats. These are all financed items, right? So the fact that, again, back to the real economy where people actually have to borrow money in the banking system, you know, survey after survey, 39% of Americans say they can't pay their bills. That was 37% in the GFC, the Great Financial Crisis. So we're now worse than that in terms of people saying they can't pay their bills. 50% of Canadians say they can't pay their rent or mortgage. And the latest Ledger survey in Canada said 63% thought the economy was in poor shape. So all of these just show, you know, that it's caught up. It's finally caught up. The debt hangover is there. It's huge. In the real world, companies are struggling to refinance. Individuals are struggling to refinance. And it's not as easy as just cutting rates a bit and re-stimulating, because when people took out the bulk of this debt when rates were at zero, you know, the fact that mortgage rates in the U.S. are back under 6% doesn't help if the majority of people have existing mortgages, you know, at rates of 4%. That's not going to stimulate anything, because you can't port mortgages in the U.S. for the most part. You have to qualify for a new one. And even in Canada, again, if the bulk of the mortgages, and they were taken out when interest rates, mortgage rates were at extreme lows, you know, in under 2% in many cases, then it's not going to help people that mortgage rates have come back down to the 5% range in Canada. It's not stimulative. So it's not enough in and of itself.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, was the road to Canada's financial hell paved with good intentions?
Yeah. I mean, I saw this at the time when it was happening. A lot of people were, you know, trying to help, I always say in quote unquote, help young people to get into the property market. And they were doing that out of an interest in being supportive and thinking it was the right thing to do. But the problem was they were helping people into things that they couldn't actually afford to maintain themselves. And so ultimately that's not help at all. That's like putting a big rock around someone's foot and throwing them out to try and walk around with that. And we've seen this over the years in different ways. I mentioned the book Millionaire Next Door. The Millionaire Next Door is a 1996 book, but they documented all these studies that have been done to show that helping adult children, parents helping adult children, meaning well and all, but actually financially they put them behind the eight ball, because they end up, you know, not being self-sufficient and having a cost structure that they can't actually service. And we're seeing that certainly today. Canadians need 98% of their disposable income in Vancouver and 80% in Toronto just to cover their housing expenses, Jim. Like, it's lunatic fringe. And a lot that I put the link to the Housing Affordability and Parental Income Support, which is a working paper directly from some of the Bank of Canada staff. It's fascinating to read, because they point out that, you know, whether it was parents down co-signing on mortgages and or helping with down payment assistance, the average person who was buying in the past few years did so with a couple of $100,000 down payment courtesy of their parents. And many of those parents either took that money out of their own savings or borrowed against their house or line of credit in order to advance those funds. And then another 12% or so had to actually co-sign on the mortgage to help first-time home buyers get in to the market. And then what's happened, Jim, as you know, is that the prices have not gone up in the last couple of years. Indeed, they're coming off at the same time that these debts have been coming up for renewal. And you've got, you know, baby boomers are currently over 70 years old. So 70 to 78 is the current wave of baby boomers. A lot of them are the ones who are borrowing against their homes to try and help, whether it was children or grandchildren. And so everybody's got less actual savings at the end of the day because of all this, because they were putting so much of their savings towards trying to get into the property market. Those asset prices have now stagnated or they're falling in many cities. And the cost of carry has gone up so dramatically. And so people are saying, well, you know, as mortgages come up for renewal, it's impossible, right? They just can't renew. They can't keep this up. And so a lot of those parents are actually having to not only do all those other things, but also give adult children payment help month after month out of their own cash flow. So you can see that something's got to give here. And ultimately, it's financially stressful for all the parties, the kids, the grandkids, in some cases the grandparents did this. Like, it was just horrible. And of course, policymakers were horribly complicit in this, because, as you know, politicians were being lobbied to make it easier and easier for people to access the housing, you know, get more easier to borrow, you know, can a mortgage and housing buy down the rates somehow, like get people to be able to get in. And then we've got, of course, the primary residence full tax exemption in this country, which is an incentive for people to want to double down on housing to begin with. And then you had all the investment, so-called investment flows that were coming in, both from private equity funds, private credit funds, so the investor class, as well as all the, you know, first-time home buyers, the boomers buying second and third homes. So just a mosh pit of activity. And we knew that at the time, again, because we could look at the fact that it was driving the primary driver of Canadian GDP in the past, in the decade before this, was really that the housing market, all the activity that was going on, the transactions, the commissions, you know, the property tax inflows to municipalities and provinces, that was all a huge part of economic activity. But at the same time, the investment in machinery and, you know, things that improve and create jobs and cash flow for the future was negative over this period. So it was just this, you know, again, preoccupation with housing at the expense of everything else. And now, of course, we've seen this horrible productivity numbers in Canada. And now we're left with this weight, this dead weight in the economy. You know, Canadian household debt to GDP got above 180%, the worst, debt to disposable income got the worst of the G7. And, you know, I've just been following, as we've discussed before, the whole, you know, the expectation again was, well, when the Bank of Canada starts cutting rates, this will all be fixed again. But you gotta look at what the existing mortgage book, what the rates are. And as they say, if the rates are less than 3%, and the bulk of them are, then you're not gonna have any relief on renewals, and we need incremental new spending, and you're not gonna have ability to refinance and you know, take equity out to pay down other bills like people were in the habit of doing. And we've got revolving consumer credit has actually been contracting. In June, the latest numbers were that people are not adding to credit now because they have no income ability to do it. And then you've got a bunch of realtors saying, you know, it's a buyer's market, but, you know, only if you're able to actually buy and afford this stuff. And the payment structure is just obscene. So all of that to say, you know, yes, maybe a lot of people meant well, but now they're faced with trying to sell. And that's why we're seeing this big spike in listings nationally in most markets at the same time that the actual transactions are really muted. And so it's just getting more and more top heavy.
Toronto. We're seeing all these headlines saying the condo market is in meltdown. People are selling at huge losses. Is that going to become a national contagion?
Well, it's, you know, there is, of course, this idea that housing can be more local than national. That's true. But I like to point out that it's really a function of, first of all, where the bulk of the population lives, which is in the Vancouver and Toronto areas. That's where the bulk of this frenzy was in the past several years. That's where the greatest appreciation in home prices took place. That's where the greatest leverage was added on. The biggest share of residential mortgage debt was taken on in those centers, where incomes were on average higher than the national figure in Canada. So what does that mean? That meant they could actually borrow more than the average household. But even there, you know, that the average income is still only about $80,000 a year, and you had the average home price way over $1 million. So, you know, I was putting the historical data, because most people aren't aware that, you know, we had Canadian home prices go from $67,000 on average in 1980 to $566,000 on average by 2020, and then to, you know, more than $800,000 in the 2 years after that. So that ends up being, you know, 10 times the median household income. And so totally unaffordable. Historically, 3 times was the maximum anyone could be expected to maintain in terms of what they could afford and have still money left to eat and things, buy some shoes, you know, that sort of stuff. So, what's happening now is that investors have been burning cash. I was writing about this at the time, even when rates were low. They were paying so much for these units that their cash flow was negative even back then. And they were tolerating that on the assumption that prices would only go up. So they were saying, oh, well, we're not making anything on the rents, but we're not worried because, you know, the price is going up 10,000 bucks a month kind of thing. Well, now it's not. And many of them are weary now of this whole cash burn scenario where they're, you know, running through their average loss is more than $1,000 a month. And they're saying, well, this is crazy because the price isn't going up now and they want to sell. And the biggest complaint from realtors, of course, is that people are unrealistic and they're wanting to sell for a price that they imagined they could have got, you know, a couple of years before, or the price they bought it at during the frenzy. And those prices are routinely, you know, the going price, if you can find a buyer right now, is routinely, you know, 20% plus below where prices were a couple of years ago. So it's really also this, we knew at the time that the amount of cranes in Toronto, as an example, was the largest of any city in North America. There was so much high-rise and condo building going on. And so that's really, you know, come home to roost now because they got to be so expensive, so much supply, and there's still a bunch in process that hasn't even come to market yet, and we know that that's going to be completed, a lot of that in the next 12 months. So it's just really showing, you know, when you follow the listings, that places are selling for more than 20% losses already. If a person actually decides to cut bait, like just say, I can't afford to carry this negative property anymore, or, you know, I can't refinance it because the rates are higher than when I took it out. So they all go, well, we'll sell it. You know, we'll just sell it. And then, of course, that's why listings are surging. And when they, if they're actually getting a buyer, the buyers are coming in so much lower than the prices that are being expected.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. We'll ask that question for you. Find us on X at House Street. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com Radio is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.